Okay, so I am here with Nelson George, who is most recently the author of City Kid. Nelson, how are you doing?
Good to be here and doing an interview in Soho.
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful Soho.
The middle range from going from one territory to the other, as you note in your book.
But
speaking of territory, I want to actually, first of all, initiate this conversation about your New York Times article about Fort Greene.
Okay.
You recently wrote this piece, and you described how the neighborhood had gentrified, writing, "Once the aura of danger left Fort Greene, its many charms could no longer be hidden." And you note how white people stick to the new yogurt bars and the latte bistros instead of the neighborhood establishments like the Brooklyn Moon Cafe. If this is the nature of change, or whether the black artists who once thrived in that particular area bear some responsibility for fleeing and not preserving, the character. Or is it just a lot more complicated than that?
Well, I mean, the black artists who made the neighborhood worth having.
Yeah.
I mean, there's two things about Fort Greene that have been great. It's convenience to Manhattan, and it's real estate. It has some of those beautiful brownstones, I think some of those beautiful blocks in New York City. And, to give the devil his due, pre-Giuliani, there was a lot of crime, but the crime was an opportunity because there were these great buildings. There's a lot of older black homeowners, Latino homeowners, who've been there for years and years, who bought it, really in the 70s and 80s when the market was really down. And the neighborhood was, for all its charms, was considered, it's Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And Brooklyn had a wide berth of not being a place to stay. The artists who were there, from Spike to Chris Rock, a lot of them still have real estate in the area.
Yeah.
Rosie Perez still lives there.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Wright, the actor. I mean, there's a lot of folks still there. But obviously, it's been ameliorated. It's been balanced out or changed. The presence of younger white people and white couples is really present now. There's always been white homeowners because in the area.
Yeah.
But that is, now it's, the balance has tipped, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And also the other part of it, which is not, that's the natural evolution. I think what would have been more problematic is the high rises, actually. Because I think that's really going to be the destruction of the area. Because Fort Greene is, where it's situated, there's only two or three exit ways to the Manhattan and Brooklyn Bridge. Really, the main ones tend to be Fulton, Atlantic, Flatbush. If you ever tried to get over the Manhattan or Brooklyn Bridge in the morning or rush hour, it's a parking lot now. The addition of, I even take the Atlantic Yards out of the equation, but if you just take the things that are already up, Forte, the people who are going to be living at the Clock Tower building, there's two or three new buildings going up, Torrin and a couple of other places around there, and there's a couple of other big holes in the ground. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, that's at least, I'm going to say 20,000 people, but I'm probably being conservative. It's probably 30 to 40. The thing about the area was that it was always very livable. The scale of living there was amazing in terms of you could see vistas. You had this beautiful park. I don't know how that area maintains that charm that made people want to come to it.
Yeah.
With an additional 50,000 people, not counting the folks who come for Jay-Z's Welcome Home to Brooklyn concert or the Nets games.
Yeah.
So it's... it's going to be interesting. I think, like I said, a lot of artists who we're talking about have actually still have places there. But it's not simply that. It's the scale of... I said this in the article. When I saw the Corcoran Group sign, I knew it was a rap.
Yeah. But there's this nature of change that one is going to have.
Well, I'm from Brooklyn.
Yeah,
I've lived through many changes. I'm not saying change isn't going to happen. Change always happens in New York. The history of New York is ethnic development. The difference is, and I think that's what's interesting about this era, is I lived in a Brooklyn where white people flee.
Yeah.
I lived in Brownsville, which was a Jewish area for decades. East Flatbush. I went to school through Canarsie, Flatbush itself. These were all Italian, Jewish, white ethnic areas my whole life, which are now as Caribbean as they are probably anything else, with a new influx of Asians. The difference in Fort Greene, I've never lived through the other side. I've never been in an area which was predominantly black that's become white. I've never lived in a predominantly white area my whole life. So it's interesting. So that's what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about all of that. And the particular nature of Fort Greene is that it's been an artist area. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are a lot of, Colson Whitehead lives there. The short story writer Torre. And there's a bunch of other, well-known, a lot of writers there now. So I just wanted to write about that phenomenon, which is a new phenomenon for the city.
Well, to talk about the artistic, in writing about your making of life support in this book, you noted that you were interested in turning your sister's struggle into something artistic. And yet earlier in the book, you also confessed that a lot of your relationships, the string relationships you went through, had much to do with the fact that you were so focused right. on pursuing the artistic. And so I'm wondering if what balance you strike between pursuing or, you know, mining your personal life when pursuing the artistic, whether there's a kind of danger here in constantly perhaps relying on the personal for artistic moments. What's the ratio?
Well, there was a difference. I wasn't really relying earlier on it. I was writing out of my head. Yep. The stuff I did... Deaf Rhythm and Blues is a good example. It's an intellectual view of a history of music. Motown book. The difference between life support is that it actually is emotional.
Yeah.
The other things were disconnects or projects of my mind that had that didn't have a lot of. Didn't, to me, they had an emotional context to the music, but they weren't my story.
Yeah.
And the way that this book is City Kid, and the way that life support is. So they're different. They're different works, and also different times in my life. So there are examples of the journey you take when you begin writing or begin doing any. You know, I think most artists in their 20s are so anxious to get on and to make their statement that they're almost arrogant about their perception. And that's a pretty common thing of young people in general. And I think that I'm humbler and a lot more understanding of the nuances of people's relations than I was. Because I was full on. People come to New York. I mean, most people come to New York to become something. I don't think people come to New York to find, you know, their comfortable lifestyle. It's not a town for that. I mean, you can have a glitzy lifestyle, you can have an expensive lifestyle, but it's not going to be living in the suburbs or in the country. It's going to be, I'm here to get on. And coming from the outer boroughs, you have that same feeling. Growing up in Brownsville, I know it was a 40-minute ride to Manhattan. I mean, I might as well have been in, you know, I could have been in Jersey for yeah. all of that. So when I had my opportunity in my 20s to try and make my mark as a writer, I was kind of relentless about it. And it was the most important thing in my life, more important than any girl I met, certainly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm 50, 51 now. It's a different world for me and how I relate to the work. So, I mean, I think the two... You know, the guy who wrote the Deaf Rhythm and Blues and the guy who wrote Life Support, while the same person, have different perspectives.
But I'm curious, over the years, as you were really hungry for this particular artistic life, this writing life, how you were able to balance, again, the notion of the personal or drawing from the personal with your love for music, your love for film, your love for just writing in general. Because of these two observations, which I just cited.
I don't think they're inbound. I don't think they were imbalanced. I mean, there's no balance. When I was that age, I was about making it.
Yeah.
And everyone I was around, you know, that the great thing about that area, and I was talking to Lorna Simpson, who still lives there, a very famous visual artist. You know, you walk outside and you know that Lorna's doing some work. You know that Spike's doing some work. You know that Lawrence Fishburne's doing work. You know that Branford and Winton. And everyone was, you know, it was not a sense of competition because it's interesting. You know, people were, a lot of different disciplines were around. So it was more like, am I going to keep up with my peers? Am I going to manifest my talent and my ambition as these folks are? And, so it definitely wasn't in balance. There was no thought of balance. Balance wasn't even on the on the menu.
Yeah, it was just simply living, and artistic and personal just happened, and you kind of tried to manage and jump through the hoops as they came.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's something I think about more now. But, I mean, you know, what is it, child is father to the man? Is that saying? You know, I had to do that. I had to get that out of me because that was... I would have been one of those very frustrated people. One thing I never wanted to be... was that person at the party who said, well, I kind of wanted to fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And didn't. And there's that kind of melancholy that they have, and I didn't want to have that.
Well, to talk about this notion of fatherhood, I mean, you grew up, you had a father who was away from you, and you also, at some point later on, decades later, became something of a mentor to numerous artists, a collaborator. You helped out a number of people, including Spike and Chris Rock and the like. But I'm curious as to what was the turning point for you to become from fatherless to father. Was it simply soaking up a lot of Hemingway, the sexual misadventures? What do you think it was that turned you into the kind of mentor figure that you describe later in the book?
I don't know. I always had, I was always a supportive person. I know I always was interested in what other artists were doing. And it's interesting, one of the things I've been able to be friends with a lot of different people is that I'm never jealous. I like people to fulfill their potential. I feel very engaged when I see someone who I think has something and is a few steps away or a certain point from getting where they should go. And I've always enjoyed that immensely. Something about people fulfilling their potential that, I like it. I mean, it's funny, it's something I relate back to my mother. You know, she was a school teacher, and my mother was a natural teacher. I mean, even before I, you know, went to school, she had taught me my ABC. She already was already kind of in that mode and didn't even know it yet. Mm-hmm. And I guess that, I always say, I go back to her and say that maybe that's part of it. When I watch my sister now, I go out, and if I see her do a presentation for people who have the HIV virus, be it a bunch of VA hospital guys, a tough group of ex-soldiers, or young pregnant black women, she has the same quality. I just think maybe it's in the DNA of our family to this. And it took me a minute to understand that was something that was a skill or something worth doing. You know, I mean, it's like when you I don't think most artists start out to want to help other people. They start out, I wanted to do my thing. But I found myself over and over again in that position and enjoyed it. And then I just came to accept that this is part of who I am.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'd like to tie this in relation to the concept of ass power, which was given to you by Quincy Jones.
Right.
This notion of constantly working at something until you actually accomplish something good, which he identified in Michael Jackson. Ass power seems to crop up in your own writing. You note in this book that you're constantly writing every day. You keep a notebook on you. But going back to this notion of mentorhood, with Chris Rock, he came to you. He didn't have characters. He didn't have anything like that. You told him, guess what? You got to go ahead and come up with a story. You got to come up with characters. And he returned with that particular scenario. I'm wondering if in Chris's case that was a scenario of ass power or whether that was just a matter of nudging someone, because not everybody is going to be motivated by this idea of ass power. There's some people like to think about something or feel about something before they just spill it out on the page or essentially ahead.
But you can spill it out, but you still have to. Nothing happens without ass power. In other words, inspiration is inspiration. Inspiration doesn't fill 300 pages.
Yeah.
Or 400 pages. Inspiration gets you there in front of the typewriter, and it gives you the idea, but you still have to put the time in. Inspiration doesn't give you a movie or a great record. You still have to. Great art, and bad art for that matter, is all made, in my experience, in little rooms. And that little room is an editing room in California. It's a writer's den in Brooklyn. It's someone's basement studio in wherever. All great work comes out of these little rooms.
Yeah.
And that's what I've seen over and over again. So that idea of having the discipline to stay in these rooms and get the work done is essential. It's funny, I was talking to Chris recently, and he said to me that I was the first writer he'd ever met. That is to say, that someone who actually made their living, you know, writing. I think it was kind of like, wow, that people like that exist. Because he had been around comedy entertainment. So I think also a big part of mentoring is role modeling. Simply, sometimes being a person who's creating and not, you know, not doing it just for aggrandizement. I actually don't think, if I couldn't write, I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I just needed to write. And the writing every day doesn't come simply out of the discipline part, it comes out of the joy part. Mm-hmm. I really love it. And I think that was a good thing for him to see. And not so much that he became a writer, though he writes all of his material and is a great stand-up writer, but the idea that every day, and that you work on your craft and continue building it. And I think that was something that he's taken on, and now he's a role model. I see other comedians, you know, I know a lot of comedians who admire Chris, but they haven't put the time in.
Yeah.
And I saw what he did.
Does it have to be a tiny room? Does it have to be so tied into place? Because you mentioned 19 Willoughby, that apartment that you had, in which most of your work actually occurred. You also allude to the idea of, well, hey, I want to go ahead and produce a bookshelf of books. And I'm curious about this because there seems to be something almost topographical or geographical in your writing process and in your life process. Is writing permanently tied to place, much like the bench that Richard Wright wrote Native Son on? Or?
Well, I mean, place is very important. Everybody I've ever interviewed, successful artists I've interviewed over the years, usually has had a place that was the breakthrough place. I interviewed Leslie Babyface, the songwriter and performer. And he talked about when he first moved to California, he and L.A. Reid, his partner, had a place on, God, I know the street. Had a place off Franklin, and I can't remember the cross street, but it's off Franklin. Franklin's a street out in California, it's Hollywood. And they had an apartment. And they got some money, the first time they had any money, moved to L.A., they bought all this equipment. And they were in a room, and I said to him, you know, he named like eight humongous records, from Bobby Brown to Whitney Houston to, you know, it had this amazing run of hits. They were written in this room when they first got to California. And that spurt was tied to the possibility of having someone was willing out there to record the records, and just the new sense of possibility that they had. So, and a great many, you look at Hemingway, he talks about Paris and his room, you know, room he lived, he worked in, a couple of, in his biographies, a couple of rooms when he first started out doing In Our Time, and also I think Sun Also Rises. So, you know, over and over again, you know, these places, I mean, Hemingway is a good example. I mean, all of it, I mean, his place in Cuba is famous. Where you live, it's famous, it's important to artists on two levels. One is, you know, that place of regularity, stability that you're creating allow you to, you know, have the time, the ass power time. The other thing I think is, you know, funny, in the age of internet and the age of all this technology, artists don't need to see other artists. They actually, you know, you can communicate in there, but it's always about, the best thing about Twitter is I'm going to meet someone somewhere. I mean, it's all about guiding you to a place where we can commune. And that's what Fort Greene was like for me. It was a really good place to see people and to be around people, my peers. And I think that idea of being around peers, and that goes, and you can look at New York, you can look at the village art scene, you can look at the jazz scene, hip hop, you can look at every major movement in New York art, and you will find a place and a neighborhood.
But in your case, you had gentlemen with television sets coming into your backyard. Was this a factor into this notion of place, that people came to you in rather unusual ways? Or?
I mean, there's no place in New York that didn't, I mean, have crime. I mean, The entire, you know, punk rock scene and CBGBs, the guerrilla art scene, that, you know, John Michelle and Billy, that came out of not far from here. I mean, when I used to walk through this area when I was in high school and, you know, college, this was, there were a few spots like this. There were art galleries. You know, I think Martha Cooper was around in a few places. I didn't even know what they were. Now I know what I was going by.
Yeah.
And you'd hear, you know, there were some, what they call loft jazz spots. But that sense that this was kind of open, that no one was living here and you could come in and just take this stuff over, created a whole scene of jazz musicians and artists that that are legendary now, you know?
Well, if you mentioned the jazz class that you took at St. John's, and I actually was very curious about this because you pointed out that there were very rigid distinctions between black music genres that came largely from the projection of the people who were classifying these, the writers and the audiences, but that it never came from the musicians. Do you think that essentially this largely remains the case today? Are there less barriers now to cross-genre fusion and the like? Or?
I think the idea of mixing and matching is what's driving most world music. And I think that's the, you know, one of the things that hip hop was really, that doesn't get enough credit for as music, not as emceeing, is that the DJ's ability to take the entire spectrum of music and transform it into this chop it up and spin it around became the metaphor for all world music. When I go to London, or if I go to France, or I go, it's all the most interesting stuff is the stuff that's hybrid. You go to Africa and you hear African musicians in London or Paris for that matter, and every, hybridization is the nature of music. I think that the sampling technology that hip-hop popularized has really helped spread that idea. So, you know, I think that the idea of mixing and matching is what it's about, and the fusion of cultures, the new fusion of cultures.
Yeah.
And ultimately, what's going to be interesting about Brooklyn is, I mean, my favorite band of the moment is TV and Radio. And, you know, it's a mix of some guys who are African-American. There's a white guy who's sort of the guitarist and the producer, who's done a lot of other bands, Yeah, some stuff. And I like the fact that this is, and their music is embedded this kind of beautiful harmony vocal style, very discordant, you know, almost pulsing guitar lines and stuff. I just think it's really, that itself is a fusion of completely different elements. To me, that's what world music is about today.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if you think that some of the criticisms you level at WBLS in the late 70s and Frankie Crocker, you point out that his effort, I mean, he had a real power to determine which bands played in New York at the time. And you had problems with that because he didn't actually adhere to, I suppose, the old soul, the old values that
came
up.
Well, not even
up.
So. I mean, the thing was there were other progressive movements in black music.
Yes.
Funk, in particular, was something he didn't give as much value to. And he sort of defined what New York listened to and became. And wasn't as ecumenical as he would seem. A lot of it was determined by payola and other forces aside from his taste.
Well, certainly. But I mean, do you think though that Hot 97, for example, actually lives up to this kind of world music, this fusion of multiple genres that is acceptable to you, or is there just really no solution that can be had?
Acceptable? It's not acceptable. It's not about acceptable to me. It's just simply that Hot 97 is a hip hop station. What's happened is that awards like hip-hop has become a box. So it's not as flexible a format as it could be. Because there's very different ideas of what a hip-hop record is. There's very different ideas. I mean, that's you know, we're in an incredible era of fragmentation and micromanaging of culture. And, you know, each radio station, like each internet station, becomes a subset of a subset. So in some ways, some of the people who are commercially programming are less tied into the idea of fusion than ever before, because it's about narrowcasting. You know, that's where they make their money. Well, the only thing that's interesting about, I mean, I would say about that, the only counter argument I would make is that with kids particularly, novelty becomes the fusion point. If someone comes up with a new beat, there was this beat that came out of dance hall that everyone was using for 5 minutes. You know, I listened to Hot 97 the other night. Every goddamn person that has auto tunes on their voice.
Yeah, I know. I hate that.
It's just so. I mean, that's the thing about the narrowcasting. That the thing like auto tunes. Okay, everyone has to have auto tunes. So we don't play that record. That's the kind of thing that I think is problematic.
Technology is more of a curse than a blessing these days?
It's how technology is used.
Yeah.
I mean, in the record industry, what's left of it, is the people who run the companies now are very afraid. So the idea that if auto-tunes is happening, every major artist that we have has to use auto-tunes. That's the kind of lemmings thing that I'm talking about. And it's unfortunate. And I think it limits what a lot of young people are exposed to.
Yeah. Let's go back to your journalist career. I'm bouncing around here, but I'm curious, because you don't actually note it in the book, you point out that you went to a party, you saw Robert Christgau there, and you said, hey, can I get some work, please? And he said, Nelson, you're not ready.
Right.
Then, two chapters later in the book, you're writing regularly for The Voice.
Right.
When did he determine when you were ready, or what happened here? There's a missing little...
To me, I think the strategy of the book is it's not an autobiography. It's not everything that ever happened to me. I tried to find turning points. The chapter that's in with Bob is a section about New York when I was sort of roaming around. I mean, that comes right off the section with Soho and the Village.
Yeah.
And the idea that the city was what I learned then. It wasn't as interesting to me to talk about Bob giving me the job as Bob not giving me the job, or actually not getting the job, ultimately, you know. I mean, but what happened is I just kept sending him stuff. And I got a job at Record World magazine in January 81. And so I began writing more regularly. And I kept, you know, I just kept sending him clips. And I hit him with two records. And early, because this hip-hop thing was just getting on vinyl. It just been on vinyl a little bit. There's a record by Lovebug Starsky on Harlem World Records, which was a club up in Harlem. And I wrote about that, and he gave me, that was a short piece. And then I did a second short piece about Grandmaster Flash and the Great Adventures of the Wheels of Steel, which is a very innovative and one of the first times that DJing, as we know it, was on record. You know, cutting and scratching and the mixing and so on. And I did those two pieces. And so then I got in and then I did my first big piece, which was on Rick James' Street Songs album, which I mentioned Rick James a couple times in the book, I think. But that was it. Once I got in there then, I started really writing a lot. So yes. I don't know, that must be 81 or 82.
Yeah. Well, I'm also curious because you mentioned a couple of instances. For example, you're going to Prince's apartment. Prince isn't there to listen to Parade. And you also note this Las Vegas junket that you went on in which you got this hotel room.
That was
and
crazy.
I'm saying to myself reading this, you know, this isn't exactly the most ethical journalism imaginable. I'm wondering if these thoughts were ever in your mind while
you
were
doing it. I mean, ethical journalism? It was a junket.
But yeah, but
everyone you go ahead, went on junkets in Vegas.
Yeah, but if you take a studio's money to go on a junket.
Everyone's a junket. I was 20 years old. They don't give me a flea trip to Vegas and have a hotel room. I'm going.
Okay.
And, I've never been to Vegas. I don't even have ID. I don't know how I got on the plane. You know, I had a Social Security card. I didn't have a car or anything. I mean, that was an amazing, you know, I was going to go do that. I mean, that was just amazing. I couldn't believe they let me go.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it wasn't really, I mean, Amsterdam News at that point, I mean, it was not a bastion of journalistic ethics, certainly. The Prince thing is different. The Prince thing was actually a real... That was like he was going to give me a leak of the album.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. I mean, that was a big deal at the time. That would have been a big coup.
But he wasn't there to answer any particular questions you might have had. And essentially he got, as you point out, the coverage that he absolutely engineered.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm wondering if this is really journalism or not.
You wouldn't have written the article?
I probably... Well, I would have done it. I would have established conditions personally, but that's just me.
Conditions? What conditions would
you
have?
Well, I mean, in terms of like,
there?
Yeah, well, the Prince would be there or ask for
I was told Prince was going to be there.
You were told Prince was going to be there, and he eluded you. Yeah. But
I wasn't mad that Jill Jones played the album for me.
Yeah. Fair enough. But, I mean, there was also a point when you were let go from the Amsterdam News, and you were sort of thrown into this freelance world where you were both writing articles and writing press releases.
Now,
and,
you know, I didn't really do a lot of press releases. I did a couple. I did more bios, actually.
Okay.
You know, like
the Michael Jackson story.
No. Like bios.
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah.
For $100, $50.
But I'm curious. Okay, so you're past your 20s. At what point did some sort of ethical notion of journalism kick in, or was this never really an issue? This notion of junkets or anything like that.
Ethical notions of journalism. I was a 23-year-old kid trying to make it. And the truth is, the record business is. I don't know how much you've done or been around it, but. Not the most ethical business. I mean, I was considered a pure... I mean, people are getting laid and getting hookers sent to the hotel rooms.
Yeah.
Cocaine is everywhere. I mean, it's really everywhere. I mean, most independent promotion guys were basically coke dealers. It was a very, very grimy world. And once I got a real job, I didn't do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't have to. But I mean... There's not a young writer, especially, I would say there's not probably a young music writer who hasn't done a bio for a label, especially in their early 20s. I mean, I doubt there's been a young music writer who hasn't done a bio. And all the guys I talked to at Billboard when I went up there, all the old guys told me I missed it because that was really the money, you know, in their world, the late 70s, early 80s was really, I mean, guys got flown I remember one of the guys, there's a famous junket that Island Records had where they wanted to put reggae on the map. They would fly down oodles of, you know, reporters to Jamaica to meet Bob Marley.
Yeah.
And to meet blah, blah, blah. And so it was pretty typical. because there wasn't really that much money. I mean, except for Rolling Stone, which actually had a budget, no one else really had the money to do that. So it was very typical for labels to fly you to such and such to interview so and so or see a band. That, and what's interesting is that even Prince, I mean, Warner Brothers, I believe, at some point sent a lot of journalists to Minneapolis because no one had been there to see what the fuck it was.
Yeah.
So that was pretty typical operating procedure.
I also wanted to ask you about the insularity of sports journalism. You have the Reggie Jackson episode versus the insularity of arts and cultural journalism.
Right.
What specifically drew you to those boundaries beyond the world that the particular subject inhabited in cultural journalism that was not there in sports journalism?
I just didn't like the world. I mean, you talk about ethics. Have you covered sports?
No.
Okay. Well, I mean, every sports team has a... there's a spread for all those. I mean, you know, Yankee Stadium, there's alcohol, there's free booze, there's free food. The journalists are pretty catered to in that world. To get access to the athletes, unless you establish a really good relationship with that athlete, it's really, really hard. You can meet them in, I mean, it's a very cordoned off world in terms of relationship between the press and the athletes. And it probably was maybe less so in a way then because it was they weren't as many intrusive websites.
Yeah.
But I thought that, you know, I would sit there and I'd sit in the press box also. You know, and I think there's no cheering in the press box. I mean, it's a tomb. So I was like used to, hey, the Yankees have scored. I mean, it's silent, you know, and so I didn't feel like this is a very comfortable place. I came into sports as a fan. And I didn't want to be dispassionate about the games. I didn't want to be removed from that. I just didn't feel that was, I didn't want to take the joy out of sports for me that way. And I met Dick Young, who's kind of a legendary guy in New York sports and kind of a interestingly complicated man in my brief dealings with him. And I don't know, I didn't find that. Even today, I haven't done any sports writing in a while. I think the last piece I did was a couple of years ago. But the whole going into the locker room, I mean, dudes are naked.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the, you know, people say locker room. No, dudes are walking around naked. Like, whatever. I'm going to spend my entire life walking around with guys with towels on. That's not attractive to me.
I'm wondering if you had a desire. Did you have a desire more to be an advocate of some kind that you felt that, for example, with the film work you did?
Well, just the film work and all this stuff was much more integrated in the community, you know, in the sense that obviously sports has its resonates socially, but, you know, the films themselves were about that. A lot of the music was about, or came out of these areas or places I was interested in. So it was a more natural fit. I mean, athletes are not... you know, they're not the brightest. I'm not saying they're all dumb. I'm just saying they're not that inquisitive. And now they're even in some ways less so because they make more money.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel them. They weren't that interesting as subjects to me. Whereas, you know, a struggling young filmmaker or musician or, you know, writer was much, just to have an interview with them was much more fun. Plus, I love the history of it.
Yeah. But with a figure like, say, Warrington Hudlin, who you championed at the Amsterdam News. You mentioned having difficulty with the staff there getting someone like, say, you know, an Oscar Michaud retrospective happening. And yet, at the time, the Black Filmmakers of organization was projecting all of their films onto brick walls and onto screens. So it was just as much of a kind of harder operation to get these films seen. What made it, say, covering like a Warrington Hudlin film better for than, say, doing an Oscar Michaud film?
No, it wasn't. It was both. They both were hard because there were no advertising. Neither thing. The only thing the people up there cared about was would it put ads in the paper. And neither one really did. Every now and then, maybe a museum would sponsor, you know, a retrospective or something. So you get an ad from MoMA or someplace. But, you know, they only cared about whether or not it was, and, you know, things like Penitentiary 3.
Yeah.
Or any number of really bad blaxploitation or even post-blaxploitation movies, really, is what I was looking at, took ads out, and so that's what they wanted you to cover. I mean, the junket to L.A., the junket to Vegas for it doesn't guarantee a good review, but it guarantees space. I got to write about them. And that's what they wanted. And all they wanted was space to fill. And they knew if they knew that the film company would take an ad.
Yeah.
And so there was a very strong quid pro quo going on with in terms of the coverage. And so also, you know, there wasn't much of a constituency. You know, it's funny, now today with the internet, you can create a community. If the Black Filmmaker Foundation, there's a million actually independent black film groups of every kind, and you know, at that point there was nothing really. And so the job that Warrington was doing was creating community. And that's what the screenings were kind of about, you know, and just building awareness. These films were just not seen.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really like, the great example is Charles Burnett's Killer of Sheep, you know, which I saw in 77, 78 at some, you know, screening at some museum. It didn't get a theatrical release until, what, 2 years ago? I mean, that's how it was. I mean, those films were lost.
Yeah.
So it was it's a completely different world.
But I'm curious, at one point you decided to essentially turn to novels and turn to creating films,
right,
and turn to creating autobiographical and even other fictive films and offerings, because did you just get sick and tired of constantly analyzing or critiquing or even offering a visceral spin on the music and the films and the culture that you were soaking up? Or
yeah, I definitely got tired of it. I felt like also I'd achieved a lot of what I wanted to achieve. When I did Death Rhythm and Blues in 88, that was kind of a book I'd always figured I wanted to write a book like this, and somehow after a lot of struggle I had. So, well, what am I doing here? I mean, do I have anything else to say about this culture, this music? Not at that time, certainly I didn't. I felt like I'd really tap myself out. And in fact, I stayed at Billboard about another year after the book came out, and it was kind of a mistake, because I was really, it was over for me.
Yeah.
You know, I put all my heart into that book, and it done well. It got a lot of great reviews, and it sold well. And so I'm sitting there like, you know, I'm sort of not know why am I still here doing this work when I've, all that work led me to do the book, and now I'm still here. I'm stupid.
Yeah.
I need to go on. And that was a big lesson for me. Was, you know, if you want to be artistically vital, you have to continue challenging yourself. It's funny, I used to wonder why, you know, you'd hear your favorite musician, why are they doing an album with Strings, or why are they doing this record after they've done this incredible stuff that you liked? But my lesson from that was I had achieved something that I wanted to do, and then it felt like then I'm repeating myself. And I went through a period of wandering. I was working on a couple of screenplays, I was working on these novels, but that had been the center of my life from college, from 81 really, to, you know, 89. And then before that, I was a freelancer, so it was a big transition culturally, and a lot of people thought I was crazy for leaving a gig.
I'm curious if you felt that you could be a better advocate in your role as a kind of mentor that led you into writing your own things than you could as a critic, that maybe this was one of the kind of
I just needed to do it. And two, I had always wanted to be a novelist.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt like I'd become a writer, but I hadn't become a novelist. And I thought that's, in a way, that's how I started the journey. So it just felt it was time to try and do that. And I had a mediocre career as a novelist. I had some good, couple of good books, couple of bad ones. I don't think I was ever really great at it, but it did fulfill something I really wanted to do.
Yeah. There's one last question I wanted to ask you about, and this is in relation to the challenge of being a black person negotiating his or her relationship with white power. You write, "In my adult life, I've seen that white institutions could be unthinking, even brutal, towards black aspirations. Individual whites, either through genuine friendship or political philosophy, could be crucial allies. So while I never lost sight of racism, it became a huge part of my personal development to take whites as they came, not expecting racism or prejudice from them. And even if it were there, not to overreact, but remember it and exact revenge when I could." But is it revenge along the lines of a kind of negative emotion or a negative idea like racism? I mean, success itself is the best revenge, I would argue.
Depends what they did to you.
It
depends on what was done to you.
What did they do to you, exactly?
People can get you fired from jobs. People can try and sully your name. People can try and hurt people you love. And so, you know, sometimes if you can get them, you will.
Yeah.
This is very basic.
But how much have
you... Depends on what it is.
How much have you dwelt on this notion of vengeance? Is vengeance
not very
driven?
Much.
Not really?
Not very much. I mean, vengeance is not a very useful emotion most of the time. But, you know, selective getting back at people is always very refreshing.
When was the last time you got back at someone?
About a year ago.
And what provoked that particular impulse? You just were feeling that
no,
you...
No, but it's not so much a thing. It's just, it's... Revenge is actually very useful. It's acts of commission, not... It's not acts of omission, not commission.
Yeah.
That is, there are things that happen or opportunities that arise that you know someone who might be really good for or could help them, and you don't help them. You don't tell them about it.
Yeah. So it's really... exclusion is your form of revenge.
I would say that it's the most... It's the easiest one to apply because it involves no action.
Yeah, it involves very little in the way of true, I guess, destroying someone's career.
It's just a step back.
So yeah, therefore, it's a healthy vengeance.
Yeah, because it's too. I don't have time to be conniving. That's crazy. I'm not that. And plus, to be that, I know people who really do think that way, and it takes a lot of their time. Like, when are you going to do something for yourself?
Yeah.
But if you feel like you've been wronged by someone, and you're in a position to help them and you don't, then you've got that out of your system and you can move on.
Got it. Well, Nelson, thanks very much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you, man.
All right. Just get on down. Yeah.